But thanks for coming out to the Powers House anyway, despite the beautiful afternoon. When the board members, Bob Owen and Ian Slansky, first conceived of this idea to do an environmental series, I was really delighted. I always think of this place as a place for concerts and art kinds of things, and it was interesting to think about using this space for the community to talk about issues that are really important to the community. So I kind of brainstormed and put some ideas together and came up with this three-part series. Last week we had David Garfield, who's a journalist who wrote an article about GE and dredging in the Hudson River and what actually has gone wrong with that process and what's still left to accomplish. And our thinking when we did this series was to put together three different topics that would all have a common thread. The thread from David Garfield to today's presentation and the next one in August that I'll be doing, that thread really is care about your place, care about your environment, make sure it's done right to begin with, because it can't be undone. It was a very, I want to say chilling and startling, cautionary tale that we heard from David last week about the Hudson. If you had any of the emails or any of the messages about this series, there is a link to his website and to the article he wrote, and also to WGXC. Oh, I'm right, exactly. And it was recorded by WGXC. It's also recorded today. So this will be available for members of the community who thought they were out of the swimming. Which we now know they shouldn't do it. At any rate, our thought was not to create a series where you scare the hell out of everybody and make everybody feel guilty for everything that they're not doing, but rather to think about what it is we can do, what it is that is in our power to do, and that we can hopefully do right when we're starting relatively near the beginning. So today's speaker, Michael O'Hara, will be talking basically about how we can think about doing things right now where it comes to sustainability, energy conservation, etc. Michael is the Operational Director of Sustainable Hudson Valley. Those of you who know him here probably know a lot of other things about him as well. Since he retired from a high-tech firm some 15 years ago? Mm-hmm. 15 years ago, he's been working primarily in our area, learning about communities, learning about how communities function to address problems such as these, and to create resiliency in the community to be able to deal with issues around sustainability and conservation. So, without further ado, I have Michael, and he will talk for a while, and then he'll have some questions. And we'll try to get your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sue. And thank you all for coming today. I saw a note this morning when I was wrapping up my preparations for this presentation that started off with the number 303. It refers to the amount of consecutive months that the world average temperature has been above levels set in the last century, above the mean, 303 consecutive months. Now, for those of us who have been watching the numbers, thinking about what situation we're in with climate change and other threats to our collective lives, we can easily get overwhelmed by key data. It's just one more reason to put your head out under the pillow and go back to bed. And hopefully stay there until the whole thing blows over like a storm. And that's the way our minds are evolved to work, that we have a threat, we react to the threat, and we move on with our lives. And that intermittent response is the way our whole nervous system is organized, so that we gear up with extra adrenaline and blood flow to respond to the danger that is approaching us right at that second. But we have not evolved as quickly as the long-term threats that we're going to talk about today have developed. So we need to step out from our instinctive responses, step out from our nervous system, and step into, depending on the nature of our communities, which over the last 10,000 years since we discovered how to farm and segregate our society into different tasks and processes and divide the labor, we figured out how to make relatively stable organizations that we were calling societies, municipalities, states, countries, things like that. These tend to be relatively long-lasting and dictate in our minds the need to plan for longer than this day, this week, this month. We have been forced into thinking about multiple decades, generations, about how we're going to make things last. So with that in mind, today I'm going to explore not the facts and figures of how much CO2 in the atmosphere equals how much problem, but how we as individuals will form groups of people intending to make things easier, function better, and work for us and everybody else. So, you know the general outline of where we're at now. From an American's point of view, high unemployment, financial upset, energy prices right now are relatively high, although, energy prices are relatively high, and the climate turns out to be changing faster than even the last intergovernmental panel on climate change had predicted, because of new information that has come to light since that was published. So the range of possibilities of what one can do will depend on at what level do you have the capacity to make a difference. And so I organized this in a series of concentric circles, starting, of course, with yourself and moving outward into the larger community, that will affect what sort of actions we can do and what sort of actions we are called to do in order to have the effect that we're trying to have. If we put on our own mask first, we'll be better able to save the kids. This is the instruction that any of us who run an airplane have heard from the stewardesses. This is really important, not only for our own sort of selfish sense that we need to be self-integrated, we need to be stable, we need to understand where we're at and where we want to go. That provides us with the basis with which to interoperate with the community and make communication with the rest of the people. So it extends just a little bit beyond that out to your household, your family, whoever lives with you, about how are you going to understand and deal with the problem we're facing. And I summarize that in a very short sentence of learn as much as you can and reskill. The reskill I'll deal with in a little more detail later, but it's a phrase that comes out of the transition towns movement that has to do with learn things that will increase your own self-sufficiency, skills that our great-grandparents might have known about how to raise your own food or repair things, keep things going in a situation where you may not be able to depend on your normal externalized services and support systems. Resiliency. Reduce your own impact. Now, this is something I'll also deal with a little bit later in terms of community, but in your own household, take responsibility for what you're doing. And with this crowd, I think I can safely assume that many of us are already doing these things, consciously making choices about how can I continuously improve my own personal environmental index of harm to benefit. How can I keep cranking up that benefit and reducing the harm? Little by little, as we learn, we can keep adjusting that parameter. None of us are going to be totally impact-free. There was a fellow who tried doing that in a movie about an impact, zero
in. No impact.
No impact. I haven't seen the movie, but I read the original article in the New York Times about it. But we're all working on that individually. But the next aspect of it, though, as you're learning, as you're connecting with your own self, we have to recognize that our own behaviors need to be connected with the larger community. Now, I put up here a couple of sample personal and household resources that some of you may be familiar with. A friend and colleague of mine, David Gershon, wrote a book called A Low Carbon Diet, which is organized for families to go through a step-by-step process of understanding what your impact is and how you and the kids and various other members of the family can work together to raise consciousness within the household. And then it's organized in kind of a simple format with a lot of illustrations, and I highly recommend it as something to start if you're working with kids, especially in the household. The crash course is really something more for the adults. It deals with the mathematics of how exponential growth of anything cannot continue indefinitely in a finite world. It's available online. Chris Matheson provides the data, and you go through a series of lessons that total a couple of hours worth of your time online, or you can get it on DVD. But the essence of the program is to bring the dilemma that we face, or more properly, the predicament that we face, into very clear focus about how the amount of resources that we have, the amount of people on the planet, and how we deal with money, are all constrained by limits of growth that have to bump up against the natural limits of living on a finite planet. I highly recommend it. Now, when we step out into the larger community, your neighborhood, your municipality, perhaps even your county, there are situations where an educated person can speak up, can organize other people that are taking the first steps that I mentioned, of getting themselves to a point where they feel confident in speaking to other people about where we're at and where we might want to go. And that has to do with each of the individuals that I mentioned before taking responsibility to do whatever they can. I'm not asking introverts to become extroverts, but there's a level of participation here that really is required to make things happen, whether it be writing letters, participating in meetings, that has to do with raising the overall awareness and understanding level of the community in general, which equips people to participate in planning processes that I'll mention more specifically in a moment. The other issue that really made a difference for me years ago, I was at an environmental conference in which the room was full, perhaps 400 or 500 people of various persuasions, but all activists that were trying to save the world. And one of the folks who got up to speak is a David Orr professor of environmental sciences at Oakland College. And he started out by saying, how many people in this room are elected officials? 3 or 4 people, raise their hand. How many people in this room are planning to run for something in the next election? Another 3 or 4 people, raise their hand. He said, that's snakes. How do you expect to move to create change if you don't have your hands in the leaders of power? In a democracy, in a representative Republican democracy, the small r, the way you get your hand on that lever is to get elected. So if you're not going to run for something, support somebody who is, and get behind the local basis for change. Get somebody elected, county judge perhaps, as the case may be, or whatever position somebody feels ready to run for, at the lowest level, alderman, town councilman, it's very important to be included in the process, not only because you have support of to get your hands on the mechanisms for change, but because that effort itself introduces you to your neighbors. You go out, knock on doors, hi, I'm so-and-so, I'm running for this office, thank you very much, vote for me, vote for next door. This is a vitally important part of the process. Now, my organization has put together what we call a 10% challenge, which I would call a community-level example of how things could be organized to support reductions in climate-related harm, in which we encourage the community to take a pledge, to say, I'm going to reduce my energy expense by 10% over the following year. Relatively straightforward, easy entry into the process, and I'll give you a little more information about that in a moment. A little bit more rigorous example is what I'll also mention as an example is a process started in England a few years ago called Transition Towns, in which groups of people get together and they create a positive vision of what their community could be like, including all of the reductions in harm and increases in positive aspects, in a way that involves the non-governmental side of the community first, and then includes, as a matter of sort of a side effect, the official elected officials. So it's a very much grassroots effort. The other dimension I'll make here is Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. There's another dimension of community in which local businesses join together to create a context where buying whatever services and goods that are available locally becomes the norm, becomes what we are about as a community for a number of different reasons, which add up to improve environmental sustainability, but start from enlightened self-interest, support of job creation, the local economy, and it therefore appeals to a very wide range of people.
So many of the president of the national organizations there.
Yep,
Bali. And she's based in Bellingham.
Yep. And oh, another example. Bellingham, Washington.
Mm-hmm. Her valley has more members than the Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah, there's a video that's available online of the Bellingham, Washington, Bali branch, or node, if you want to call it that, which is truly inspiring. Because they offer all sorts of services that you would have expected the local chamber to offer that are, you know, how to develop your business, how to do accounting, and do marketing, things like that. But in addition, add this environmental extra dimension that really, really is quite effective. Now, once you work your way out in your spectrum of personal, family, neighborhood, community, your effect on these activities starts to be a little bit more remote. You know, you're dealing with national legislation, perhaps the stimulus money that was just dealt with, which had a portion of it which was allocated for energy efficiency. In the cities of Hudson, Red Hook, and Kingston, they asked for and received money for employing people or organizations to help them get more energy efficient. So it's a good thing, and it relates to what we were talking about in terms of the community. But there's a whole bunch of other things here that are happening at a reserve, at a point far distant from our daily activities here. And really, what is your influence there? Back to your education level, back to your ability to participate in the political process, the more people that we can get elected to Congress, Senate, President, that are doing at least the general direction, the better off we can be, as well as our continued efforts to influence these entities. Now, the role that you as an individual or your community plays in influencing these decisions is necessarily diffuse, at which point I would introduce the tool of getting together with the national and international organizations, operations like the Sierra Club. Don't do very much in downtown Hudson, but the collective value of all of the tens of thousands of members of an outfit like the Sierra Club focused on lobbying and educating the federal and state legislators is something very much required. And I think we need to segregate what's effective at what level and understand what effect each of those tools can have. The other way to divide up what it is we're doing, in addition to inner and outer on a scale, has to do with sooner, which usually means easier and cheaper, or later, those things which are either more complex and potentially more expensive, such as what we talk about, for example, the 10% challenge, which is turn the lights out when you leave the room, turn your thermostat up a little bit in the summertime, don't blast the air conditioner and have to wear a sweater, wear shorts. I'm modeling climate adaptation here for you today. My wife gave me a little bit of a hard time when she saw that I was going out the door. She said that, don't you need to wear long pants? I said, no, this is an old-fashioned house. There's no air conditioning. This is part of the adaptation. That you could imagine entire businesses adopting. Okay, guys, here's the plan. Starting June 1st, everybody gets to wear shorts and short-sleeve shirts. You don't have to wear a tie for the guys, and adjust to a level of temperature in the office that, if you were all dressed up in a suit, would be uncomfortable. So the easy stuff you can do, and it's amazing how much reduction in energy use can be accomplished simply by behavior change if you get feedback and track them. The later stuff, you start to think about, well, my water heater is 20 years old, it's about to require replacement, how much is a very efficient one going to cost versus a less efficient one? $30 or $40 extra, and you start to do the math because now you have adapted, if you're thinking in that way, to looking for those possibilities. So this is a more detailed elaboration on what we have been referring to as the 10% challenge. The number of the percent is really not important. Set an objective. This is classic management strategy, and then support your people in getting it. So you establish a benchmark. Where are you at now? Here in the National Grid served territory, we've discovered an online tool that works really well for tracking energy usage called EarthAid. You go online, you put in your National Grid account number, it extracts the last 12 months of your energy usage, and here's your baseline. You didn't have to go look through all the bills and write them down. And then every month they send you an email saying, Mr. O'Hara, your energy usage for the month of July was this much compared to July of last year. this much compared to the previous month, this much compared to the whole country, and this much compared to whoever else you want to be compared with. So I compare myself with my brother in Philadelphia, as well as those other comparisons, and it gives me some feedback. Am I doing all right? Am I not doing all right? It helps get people through. It's like going to Weight Watchers every week and weigh again, a little heavier, a little light. It's the sort of feedback people need. You set a target date, you give them inspiration, you provide the tools, you quantify the results, you celebrate the accomplishment at the end of the year, which then gets your early adopters, the people who started out with this thing, to do a little bit more. Because you started with the easy actions, you give them some positive feedback, yay, attaboy. And now you get them consciously ready to take on some of the more difficult and more complicated and more extensive steps. Perhaps ready to take public transportation rather than their own car, ride a bicycle. These are serious behavior changes that we're trying to get people to do. You've got to start somewhere. And every little bit counts. Now, the other factor that we like about this is that we operate first with the leadership. We go find a municipal official that's sympathetic, we get them to introduce us to everybody else, and we say, let's have a common council resolve that we as a community, as a municipal system, the buildings, the cars, the trucks, let's do an audit, let's get the reduction happening, let's be a model for the behavior that we'd like the rest of the citizens to follow, and get them thinking as a community through the channel of one of the pre-existing groups there are. So that my organization doesn't need to reinvent the wheel, they're mailing us, we work with whoever's already on the ground. Now, the obvious benefits are that you reduce the energy expense, which gives people more money to spend on other things, creating jobs that are perhaps involved in home improvement, and ideally, an improved community spirit and idealism. So, that 10% number has to do with the fact that it's 2010. It also has to do with the fact that a study done by the Independent Dutchess Energy Alliance last year showed that in a similar program that they went through, that they achieved savings of anywhere from 3% to 15% with just behaviors. Now, we're basing our attitude and our process here on a couple of different well-known principles that have been understood in social sciences, so to speak. And that is that there are people who are inclined to be the first in their neighborhood, the first among their peer group to do something new. The folks who stood at the shop front the day the iPhone 4 was introduced. Well, now they're sorry because they've got antennas, but that's another matter. But these were the earliest people to use computers, the earliest people to try innovative things, fashion forward. Now, those are the people that are most likely to respond first, but they all have friends and family who they will be role models for. They'll take the innovations mainstream. It builds political will that allows for policy that brings in everybody else. So it's not necessary to get everybody all at once. You can start with just a few people that form a seed that then virally spreads, makes my metaphors, to the rest of the community. This is a bit more detailed next steps. Inventory of public systems, you develop some plans, you commit to an action plan, and you get the rest of the community involved. Now, that's a 10% challenge. Let me spend a couple minutes talking about what I mentioned earlier, the transition towns process. Transition towns, as taken from their handbook, you can read, a grassroots movement that builds community resilience in response to the challenges of climate change, and peak oil and economic crisis. Now, I haven't spent a lot of time before. I sort of glossed over the cost of fuel before. But the Transition Towns folks started several years ago in a town in a hill called Tacos. And they have a number of different principles that they've put forward that I thought fit right in with what we're talking about here. One of those is that there's a phenomenon called peak oil, that all of the oil wells in the world have a certain pattern of depletion, that you put a straw into this reservoir, and initially the pressure of the water pushing up from below and natural gas pushing down from the top of that oil reservoir squirts the oil up, as we've seen in dramatically awful fashion with the Gulf of Mexico disaster for 85 days worth of that same sort of phenomenon. So after a while, in any productive oil well, it slopes off, and when it does, there will be less and less oil per day that comes out of a given system, whether it's an individual well or a group of them, or even an entire country. The point at which the volume per day starts to go down is referred to in the geologic circles as peak oil. It doesn't mean it just stops. It just means that it stops being as abundant in its daily flow. Now, if you think ahead, and we think as a community ahead about what will it do to our society if the oil is a little bit more expensive every year, if it's a little bit less available every year, well, you can start making plans to be more prudent in your use of the darn stuff, because it will decline. That, what they're calling on the slide, descent, is inevitable. The question is whether you want to ride that decline down or get swamped. Excuse me, this is a progressive slide. The explanation that makes this a little bit more understandable in terms of graph form has to do with the evolution of our use of energy over time. We started out perhaps 10,000 years before the present time, figuring out how to do agriculture. But with the addition of things like draft animals, horses, oxen, things like that, we really didn't use a whole lot more energy up until relatively recent times, up until the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution was associated with the discovery of the ability to use coal, which had been known about since ancient times, but the development of steam engine, which allowed us to use that heat in a way that did more work than usual draft animals or people. So if we look at the amount of energy used, we can see that it takes a steep jump up to about probably now, about the peak of the fossil fuel energy that we have ever had available to us in the past is available to us now. And it does everything that we need in our current society. The question is, how is that curve going to look in the future? Something that our great-grandchildren are going to be looking at. This is one idea, and you've seen it. I was talking to somebody the other day about my readings of magazines like Popular Science or Popular Mechanics when I was a kid. And they had all these things about flying cars and fantastic things that the future is going to bring us. And if you assume, for example, that our climate change dilemma will be solved by a plug-compatible replacement set of alternative energies, that we will ramp up quick enough to have wind power, solar, geothermal, etc., energies available to us that will just keep on keeping on. And it'll be, you know, like the Jetsons. We'll have little air cars that will take us all over the place. Or what many of us have been thinking about, well, oh, let's just, you know, smooth out our energy use and reduce our use a little bit and buy, you know, eco-friendly clothes, and maybe that'll be enough to handle things. Or maybe we'll have a complete disruption and things will really go down real fast. Now, the assumption here in terms of the energy has to do with a real drop-off, perhaps, of the availability and increase in the price. Not that the actual flow of oil will stop that quickly, but the availability per usage will create societal disruption, which will create some serious problems. What is alternatively proposed here as one of the real positive things that we could look forward to is an organized descent, also referred to in the slide as stewardship, which is to say that we figure out ways not only to become more efficient, but to reorganize the society that uses the energy. It's a big task. So as to ease our way down into a point where the amount of energy we're using is actually closer to the way it was before this brief bubble of fossil fuel availability created the opportunity to grow the population, to grow the usage of all of the energy that we now use. This is not, you know, this level of usage, no matter how you calculate it, is not able to be continued. And so the techno-fantasy and even the green tax ability is, by my reading, is really not on. So what we're looking at is a choice between the creative descent using the technologies of permaculture and a very intense community organization rather than a real breakdown. Now, the transition folks have put together a number of guiding principles that are similar to what I was talking about long ago with the 10% challenge. The 10% challenge was sort of like baby steps that we're trying to get people to take just to save money. They don't have to get involved with the concept of peak oil or climate change or anything else. They just have to save a buck on their electricity and gas use. This takes a bit more buy-in on the community's part, because people are going to be learning about their own experience and their own commitment to reducing their impact. They're collectively working on developing positive visions of how life is going to be in their community in this lower intensity of energy future, what will eventually be the fossil fuel future. The idea is to get people together in self-organizing levels to develop the decision-making at an appropriate level. Now, this is not really a parallel government, but it's the beginning of a sense of community building that is normally outside the realm of municipal or county government. They don't actively work with this sort of thing. So, part of the, I won't spend a lot of time on this, but typically what they do is set up a steering group to do the groundwork for the process and get some of the information out to people, raise the level of awareness, which then starts to create the possibility for implementing some projects, a community garden perhaps, or something else that's visible and local. Start putting people together who know things with those people who want to know things, what they're calling the reskilling apparatus. In addition to the normal resources available to all of us, as libraries and the internet and so forth. But the interpersonal exchange between especially the older folks, who perhaps have participated in some of those skills themselves and are happy to share it with the younger folks, is another important aspect of the community building system that is really happening there. And ideally what happens a bit down the line is that the community starts to envision how are we going to make that descent in an organized sort of way. Now, all of this takes into account the necessity to involve the regular, those were pictures that won't play well in reading, that to involve the local governments, because at a certain point, the transition town group, perhaps, you know, a few dozen or a few hundred people in a given town, is going to be making a little bit of a wave, making interesting things happen, that they will want to involve the planning. Now, as of March, which was the last time I had the number on this, there were some 60 plus transition initiatives, communities that have said, we're on board, we have somebody to contact, we have a little charter, we have something that says we're official in the U.S., and another 250 in the rest of the world, mostly concentrated in England, but spread out all over the place. And for every one of the official transition initiative groups, there's probably another 15 or 20 that are thinking about it. So it's gaining some interesting momentum that I thought it worth mentioning to those of you in this room, because it's one of the examples of things that are happening that I think are worth investigating, worth perhaps emulating, that would really make a difference. Now, throughout the presentation, I've mentioned the word sustainability a few times, kind of a slippery word. And there's a lot of different definitions to it. A financial sustainability means that for a company, you have enough money to pay for your staff, you are paying the rent, you're making your product, which can then be sold to generate some income. There's a self-sustaining cycle that goes in there. But what we're talking about in more general terms, and this is a quote taken from a commission that the UN formed a few years ago called the Brundtland Commission, which summarized as this: whatever we need to do to meet the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. It's a much larger vision of what we do and how that affects everybody else. How are we going to keep things together for our own community, our own selves, as well as everybody else? But I think the other term that really means a lot in the context of my presentation today is the idea of resiliency. That our ability to recover from misfortune, able to return to the original form after being bent, compressed, is out of the dictionary, is really what we're trying to develop. It's kind of like developing the immune system so that you're less likely to get disease, rather than fixing something after it goes bad. And the resiliency, the immune system response of our community can be enhanced or it can be deteriorated. And what I've been talking about is ways in which you can be a part of improving it, so that all of the elements of a functioning community can be part of the discussion. The normal pieces of our systems and our infrastructure, the food, the energy, transportation, buildings, water supply, solid waste, these are things that depend on concentrated energy and organization and money, and especially the food supply on a stable climate, such as we've had for the last 10,000 years. The climate is being disrupted. The food supply will be one of the effects of that disruption, as will any of the energy disruptions affect all of the rest of these factors. So our planning, our interaction, our cohesiveness will all enable us to respond as necessary to these changes in infrastructure and functionality. aspects of life that the community needs to sustain itself and thrive, how do we reduce our carbon emissions a lot, significantly increase our resilience, and strengthen our local economy? So that the three-part dilemma that we face, climate, financial system, and energy, can be addressed. Begin with the end in mind. Think of a plan and then build towards it. Don't just start putting pieces of lumber together. So, the next steps. Start talking, get organized, get educated, and get going. The time is short, but I think we can enjoy ourselves, we can have some fun while we're at it, while we're engaged in the great task. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you.
You had your graph there of the creative descent of the energy use per person going down.
Yeah.
Do you have in mind what an optimum population level or trend is too? I mean, we have too many people, do we have to level off our growth, or certainly when you have a pre-industrial level there where many fewer people
quite a bit
than there are now.
Yeah.
How does that compare with where we want to go?
James Lovelock, the British scientist who came up with the idea of Gaia, a sort of interconnected system of living things, made an estimate of carrying capacity that's been repeated in a lot of fora, in which he said that if you look at the amount of land, the amount of food production per acre of land and other measures, that without fossil fuels, we're probably looking at something close to a billion as a carrying capacity. So part of that descent has to be understanding that if it's too steep, we'll have some serious problems in maintaining maintaining the population, while recognizing that it really needs to come down through attrition, as it were. So, yes?
The estimation.
Sort of two parts. The first is that, like so many other communities, Axel is in dire straits economically.
Right.
It's pretty grim. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry that we don't have our council people and so on here, because I think that what you're talking about might be kind of an interesting, might present them with some interesting tools that they can use to kind of not only affect change and get some savings, but also create that spirit that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That, and so question number one is, would you be willing, if we could organize, if we could organize a meeting, mm-hmm. get those people here, person, myself, when you go
yeah.
and come back.
Oh,
that's
I
number
that.
One.
Yeah, that's what
number two is, how do you fight the despair? I mean, the people in this audience are, it's a limited number of people, most of whom are probably like-minded, and we're doing our little things, and some people are doing more things. But when I think about, for instance, my family, my daughter lives in Princeton, in an air-conditioned house that never goes off, and lights never go off, and he's an educated person who I suggest things to. I'm like, the kids can't be bothered. Now I turn them on, the kids turn them on. How do we fight that?
Well, you know,
I mean, I despair.
Right.
I know you take your own actions and you try to be positive, and I'm a negative person, and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean,
yeah,
what
my,
do you do?
Yeah, my nephew, who married my my wife's niece is a hardcore conservative guy. He's a wonderful father to my grandnephews, but I really can't have a conversation with him. I mean, he put on this recording of a John Stossel program in which he said, you know, climate change is all a hoax, and so on and so forth. So that's really off the table for our visits, for me to engage with him in that discussion. When the nephews get a little bit older, I'll subversively insert a little bit into their ears. But for the moment, I have to pick my battles. There are people who are ready to listen, let them hear. If they're not ready to listen, then I'm not going to waste my time. There's not enough time. So our strategy that I mentioned earlier of finding the early adopters, finding people who have a little bit of openness, who are wanting to know a little bit more, and you start with them, and you start at levels that are not threatening. Like, would you like to save some money? Oh, okay, I can deal with that. And then as they get into the process, they can then be exposed to other ideas about the environment, about the oil, and all of those things. But you have to start from wherever people are at, and you have to start with the people that are more ready than those who are not. Your brother may never get on board.
He's one of those tenor puppets.
Well, God bless. And he'll do what he's going to do. And there's not enough time or mental energy that you have to spend on to change it.
I guess, how has the volcanic energy affected your thinking? I've heard different things that because the Hudson River is an estuary, there is actually a possibility that some of the oil will be flushing up in the Hudson River.
Right.
Because it's picked up in the Gulf Stream. And then the other suggestion I was going to make is if you could go back a couple slides before the end and things that we can do, since these people are probably the most motivated and educated, but whatever, I don't think there are people actually have to say about these various items.
Right. Exactly.
So,
sure. Well, the oil volcano doesn't.
Don't you think that creates an incredible opportunity for what we're talking about?
I would hope.
But look how people are protesting.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But and again, jobs are.
Right. Now you, especially with climate change, you're working in the context not only of something that ought to really slap us in the face and wake us up, like the Gulf problem, but we're in the context of a well-organized disinformation campaign that's been going on for years, that has some experts at disinformation that, you know, are working full-time at just that job. So I don't know that experiential. It certainly hasn't changed my attitude about it, but it's perhaps provides an opening for talking to people about how do we, not so much, I think it's been shown fairly clearly that we do not now know how to drill an oil well 5,000 feet under the ocean. The systems that they're using were designed to operate at 15,000 pounds per square inch pressure. What pressures there are at that depth are in the order of 60,000 pounds per square inch. So just the scale of the technology, it's like trying to go to the moon with a scuba mask on. I mean, it's really, we don't know how to do it right.
That was a part of David Barker's point last week as well. We knew how to put PCBs into us, but we don't have to do it now. But
about change and getting more, building more critical mass. Many years ago, I used to work in organization change, business organizations, and we used to use a model when we went in and had to get fast change, that you've got to continue. You've got your 10% on the leading edge, the early adopters. You've got 10% who are absolutely will not change, refuse to change, and actually think that the change is wrong. And then you've got sort of this vast 80% in the middle. And when we determined that 10% that was way at the other end was not going to change until they were on a burning platform. And I think it's ironic because we now saw a burning platform. And we still don't see the 10% people changing. But you don't need those 10%, as Michael said, to make the change that's necessary. If we can take that 80% and move everybody along just a little bit and get 30 or 40 into, joining with the early adopters, it's the model that you're using, but thinking about it, that way is just moving people along the continuum. And I think you're absolutely right. I don't waste my time if you're talking to argue that this or the other.
Right. I'm curious if you guys saw requests from the local colleges or the high schools or the younger people who went to school to ask you to do presentations, because it would be my impression that it's the thing to do is get a lot of so we're all here, our median average age of care is a lot higher, so it's really but like my feeling is like, get kids interested in college, get them young. It's like, you try to get a kid interested in like piano number five. But is there resistance? I'm curious, are schools are they receptive?
Yes and no.
I reached it out to all the schools. We sent something to all of the religious trustees, to all the officials in the government here.
Right.
And it's not over here.
Yeah, unfortunately, the climate change issue has been politicized and has devolved into discussions of, liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats. Witness what has gone on recently in the Senate about support for a relatively innocuous energy legislation that really wasn't going to do very much, but that the Republicans just decided, well, anything therefore we're against. Now, that feeds down to the local side, where school administrators don't want to get involved in anything, quote, controversial. And certainly this fits into that bucket of controversy, although I have recently made presentations and workshops at RPI, as well as at a community and SUNY system college level. We have done a number of things. At the college level now, they have environmental education programs, so we just did a workshop at BARD, SUNY New Paltz, Alger County Community College. So yes, once you get up to the college level, it's fairly open. And they have programs, because the other aspect of this is that a number of people, Tom Friedman among them, have been pushing for building the economy back on the basis of all the alternatives that desperately need more work. I mean, things as simple as efficiency. My understanding of the numbers from a number of different sources, I'll give it to anybody who wants to get into it, is that without developing any sort of new technology, but with off-the-shelf technology, we could reduce our national energy expense or usage by the measurements from the dollar amount by something in the order of 80%.
Yeah.
By perhaps 2030.
California,
and that's only 20 years from now.
California did by 40 the first year, 35 permanently.
Right.
In 1 year.
Yes. So she's mentioning that California reduced their energy use by quite a bit. Now, it helped that the Enron scam set up a situation where people were overcharged by incredible amounts, which put the real fear of paying energy costs into their minds, and they went all out to try and be more efficient.
They built incentives, too.
Oh, and that became a real incentive. Yeah. To go broke. Or,
no, but the state then...
Well, then the state implemented a bit more organized incentive rather than just $1,000 a month for the bill. In any case, technology already exists, but it takes appropriate implementation with individual people. The other aspect of it is at what level can we ramp up our alternative energy production? And that same time frame is what I'm before is possible. That if we work really hard at reducing the energy use and at the same time improving the energy production from non-polluting sources, that we kind of meet in the middle about 20 years or so from now. That we can probably reduce most of our oil use and a whole lot of our coal and natural gas use through the use of energy technologies that we're all familiar with. That it takes a lot of work on the part of, and this gets into what influence that we in the room have. That starts to get into state and national energy use policy with things like carbon price. The price of a pound of carbon will be a market incentive. If we add a little bit of cost to that, which then hopefully gets either put into development of new energy resources and or given back as a rebate to the citizen made at large, which is what they've been doing in Alaska since the North Slope oil reserves. Every man, woman, and child in Alaska gets a check every year for several hundred dollars. I think it's something like $1,500. And so a family of four now has $6,000 to play with. That is just their part of the natural resource push. That's what the oil companies agreed to 2 years ago. There's no reason why we couldn't do the same thing for the rest of the population. Essentially, put a little bit of a charge on each gallon of oil. The proposal that's been made more recently about cap and trade, where you impose a cap and then that's tradable as a credit, there's all sorts of problems with it. Number one being its complexity, because all of the sources of carbon can trade with each other. And we know, I mean, we don't know, but we can imagine how many different sources there are. There's too many to count on. But if you were just impose a fee on each of the sources, then that's something that you probably hire 4 or 5 clerks to do, and it can be done manually without even having a computer. Hanging up, this oil well generated this many barrels per day, you owe us this much money, a few pennies per barrel, thank you very much. Manual calculation. Susan?
It strikes me always, you know, a carbon tax, once you're over that, is a better, a much better tool than a tax credit.
Right.
But of course, you put a carbon tax, and companies pass that on to me, and
it works its way up.
It works its way up, absolutely. And the general population gets serious in government for adding the cost. And so where I think that the carbon tax is the best answer, make it costly for people to be putting this depleting on such a thing. But it has to go in the middle of legislation. Because the powers that be are so invested in the sustainability and resiliency of their business,
right.
that without a significant amount of education, the price of that political pushback that is very hard to overcome.
The question, if you read George Lakoff's work about political language that's used, this is a very important concept of framing. Right, as well as local production.
And then rebate.
Yeah, yeah.
Given that all the tax, you know, citizens of the country, so that gets in mind.
Right, that's the elastic format, where you charge a little bit, but you give it back to everybody. Everybody gets a check. And it improves the economy, it doesn't really, I mean, it, for the poorest among us, it will improve their ability to respond to increases in costs, which are passed along through the value chain of anything that having to do with oil, which is all there. So.
Michael, can you come back to that list?
Which?
I just looked to you and we're going to talk about action steps, what we can do next. There's a hint in your second, third to last slide.
Let's see, being
there.
Like this, or?
There.
Okay. So what did you have?
I don't know. I mean, even are in their various fields. Maybe go through that list and see if there's any brainstorming that we
could have improved. Hmm. Did you know the TW model here and
more? Well, yeah.
This gets into at what point do you involve the elected officials or staff? So, for example, to start a conversation with the DPW folks about how prepared are you to have a power outage that lasts a month? Okay, how about a year? You know, what's your backup plan? Now, I know almost all of the systems will probably have a diesel generator. And so any of the electricity that's used will be locally generated. And that's as far as they go with a backup plan. But to actively go beyond that and say, well, you know, what happens if, a process that can be called scenario planning. And if you can get people who really know about the various answers to those questions, and then get them engaged in that process of what if, and, you know, staying within the realm of possibility. You know, it's not what if a meteor falls on your sewage treatment plant. It's you know, what if you have an interruption in the power bill? What if your guys can't get to work? What if you you have a level of water in your reservoir which falls below a certain point?
I don't watch television, and it's so funny. I stayed at a hotel and I was listening to junkie network news morning stuff. I don't even know if you want that.
Right.
And, you know, the woman with the fake boobs and the pretty haircut, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Said, and I'm going to come in here, I'm going to go, if your cell phone goes out, it may not be your provider because you're looking at really severe solar flares that may in fact take out the entire grid. And that actually there's been $100 million allocated just in the last few months to look at what would happen if we got zapped, if we made Wall Street go again. I mean, so this is coming from this classic.
Reporting on what had been discussed at fairly high levels in the astronomical
That's a good scenario.
Oh, but it's in that particular case, it's quite a realistic scenario. The last time there was a big solar flare occurrence, it was really before we had a lot of the electronics that we have now. So it's a concern that people, smart people are thinking about. I'm not sure whether there's some systemic answer to the question other than
cross your fingers.
But it's the sort of thing we can get over. But you can imagine a situation where it would be highly unpleasant to have a breakdown of all of your electronics. Like, you know, you're up in the plane.
Wow.
rid.
Yes. Michael, I had a question about early adoption at the municipal level. You have baseline experience now in the work with could you characterize the municipalities in terms of what the ingredients are that lends, puts them in the position of being really adopters? What are the kind of characteristics you look for as a consultant to those systems at that level?
Yeah, well, we went through this discussion with Central Hudson Power to agree on a set of parameters for choosing a community to collaborate with them on. And what they were looking for was a community that was relatively small, that had a somewhat dense traditional urban core with a somewhat cohesive community identity already, and political process that allowed us or anybody else to go in and find somebody to talk to, and that has already gone a certain amount of the way down the line. So Red Book in Dutchess County fit the bill. The Red Book Energy or Conservation Advisory Committee has been in operation for 5 years and has developed their own tools and processes for doing a benchmark of community energy use. They did a carbon footprint analysis in coordination with the BARD Environmental Studies Program. And had gotten various community officials involved, and they were fairly far along because a few individuals who lived there started something and slowly kept pushing the ball down the road. And so by the time Sustainable Hudson Valley and Central Hudson came on the scene, they were ready to be assisted in taking the steps of really implement doing more intense study, doing a set of pilot implementations of energy saving building changes, a bunch of things. But there's, it kind of goes back to this, who's ready to hear it kind of thing, that there are individuals in those communities who've already turned their study in work that are independent of what anything we were doing. That we're already moving down the line.
Can I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
As a resident of the city of Hudson and a former mayoral candidate, where is Hudson in the spectrum here of receptivity at this point? Do you think
it's in a good position. We're working out an arrangement with the city of Hudson for Sustainable Hudson Valley to be their energy efficiency consultant. There's a process that they're going through with the stimulus money that they got, which ought to be wrapped up within the next few weeks. And when that happens, I already have the mayor's positive response, and I think we'll be able to get the county council to recommit to something that they said was okay back in 2006, 4 years ago, because I already went through the process of doing kind of a high-level energy analysis in 2006, and got the cooperation of the city treasurer and a number of the city employees at that time. So now we're asking them to take another step in that direction.
Michael, it occurs to me as you were addressing that question, I was looking at this list and thinking about Johnny's question of how to brainstorm and how to get things to happen. You talked earlier about the use of power. Support candidates were get runs of office. But I think that in addition to that, and these two, it was kind of holding to a Right. They have a whole two different kinds of thoughts in your head at once about the state of affairs. These communities, all of our communities, from the, most of them are the lowest, lowest level to the national level, our communities are so polarized politically that if we come at the power, the local elected officials, in a way either that feels to them to be a political attack, or in fact is because of what they have done. And if in particular we are known to be of one political persuasion and they are known to be of another, it's toxic.
Oh, yeah.
In this part of the world. It's very, very hard to move even at a tiny point, 1 point on that to do it. But what I know that you have done, and others have done, is to come out of your, it is a fight. Come out of the fighting stance and look for points of agreement, look for points of communication, and build relationships over time that enable trust to build up.
Right.
I think it doesn't happen any other way.
You can't avoid doing the dirty work, or the detail work, really a better phrase, which is to get to know people and start to build a relationship. There's no way around it.
We also may have an opportunity here. We have a crisis to resolve that hopefully polarize people in Ireland. But we also have an economic crisis that we're playing out with almost advocating this platform that 20,000 state communities organized and solve some of the units. And that may be an opportunity because so many individual communities are having so many fiscal problems. And it may be an opportunity for us to present ideas to savings, not just fiscal savings, but by consolidating services.
Right. All the municipalities are, all the municipal officials are sweating bullets on how they're going to meet their expenses. And if the state reimbursements for certain services, state aid of various kinds is reduced, they're going to be desperately looking for any way to save money that they can. And so I think of that in an opportunistic sort of way as being a chance to get their ear about the simple aspect of how you save money and create jobs, which they have to be about.
The only thing is,
can we continue this conversation with money?
Why not? We can wrap up the formal part of the presentation and invite everybody into where?